Come to order. It is Tuesday, March 4th. This is our afternoon meeting. Please remind me when we end that we'll be recessing and not adjourning, because we will be meeting again tonight at 6 o'clock. Senator Sparks, we've had a quorum present in the room, and you may start with 1340. We're kind of behind almost 25 minutes. And it's not really anybody's fault except the Senate body, because we go too long in the session each day this week. And I apologize to everyone here. We are going to have to fly through these things, but we still want to be able to give everything a fair hearing. So, Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the opportunity to testify on Senate File 1936. This is a bill that this committee did hear last year. Passed it out of committee, and we ran into a little stumbling block on the Senate floor.
Senator Sparks, what we have is the House file in front of us, because it passed out of the House last year, 2007. It came to the Senate, and once a bill comes to the Senate from the House, they keep the House file number and put the Senate language in it. So we're looking at... We're working off the Senate language, but it's called House File 1314 for that reason, okay?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the clarification. And again, I appreciate a member taking the opportunity to listen to this today. I'm going to be brief with my remarks, because I know we have a busy agenda this afternoon as well as this evening. And today I'm honored to have with me John Bowser Bauman of the musical group Sha Na Na, who I actually saw in person at Riverside Arena in Austin a few years ago. I'm not going to tell you exactly when.
It was a wonderful show.
He is currently the chair of the Truth in Music Committee of the Vocal Hall of Fame. I would also remind members that this legislation has passed in 18 states around the United States and currently is active in quite a few more. So,
yeah, about 12.
With that, Madam Chair, I would turn it over to Mr. John Bauman.
Welcome to our committee. Identify yourself.
I am John Bauman, also known as Bowser, formerly of Sha Na Na, currently Bowser's Rock and Roll Party. Most importantly, getting big cheer outside, and
we note that.
I must say, this is like a sold-out committee room as well. I've never seen such a crowded committee room. I can't prove I am Bowser. That should do it.
Thank you.
And I am here today to speak in support of the Truth in Music Bill, which we have passed in 18 states. 12 more are working right now. The bottom line of this bill, and I can be fairly brief on it, is that imposter groups are all over the country. Particularly victimized by the imposter groups have been the old-timers, the coasters, the drifters, the platters. There are dozens of groups all over America pretending to be these people and getting away with it. The Truth in Music Bill has been working. It works as a deterrent. The shows are way down in the 18 states in which the bill has passed. And there have been actions also taken against the most significant show that creates this problem. It's a show, actually, that I'm sad to say took place in Hinckley over New Year's Eve. So this is a problem that you guys have in the state of Minnesota. And there have been actions in the state of Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and an investigation going on in Nevada with regard to this show. One of the groups has already been knocked out and is in contempt of federal court. Everything is working. We think that the passage of the bill itself alerts venues to be more careful about what they book, and the venues then become the first line of defense, because they don't want a nasty call from the AG's office saying, we think you have a show that may be in violation of Truth in Music. So the entire game plan has really been working very well, but we do need to pass all the states. Minnesota's a great music state. We all know this. Always has been. Second show I ever did with Sean, and I was here at a place called the Depot downtown, and then the State Fair many, many times, both with Sean and I and my own group, Bowser's Rock and Roll Party. This is a very important state for us. We were concerned last year when we didn't quite get through, and we want to make sure that everything goes smoothly this time, because these imposter groups need to yip, 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 boom, 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 get a job.
Mr. Bauman, thank you. On that note.
Well, thank you.
I do want to ask. I recall now that I was confused about a group as well, because they were calling themselves something, and I thought, those guys look awfully young for people that I listened to 50 years ago.
It's a consumer bill first and foremost because the public doesn't really know what it's paying to go see.
Right. Now, Mr. Bowen, is it, I mean, can these groups still sing and appear, but they just have to do the truth in advertising thing, right?
That's really what it comes down to. The bill says, simply put, it defines the recording group. The recording group is the people who made the records that you as the public have a right to go see if they're still working. The people who made the records but still have a continuing right to use the name. The performing group is the group that's on stage that night that you paid your ticket to go see. The bill says you need to have a member of the recording group in the performing group. Unless you were the holder of a valid federally registered trademark for that name. In other words, we're careful not to go into conflict with federal trademark law. If somehow the wrong person has the registration, that's going to be dealt with in a different way, you know, at the PTO, Patent and Trademark Office, not through Truth in Music. So it says you need to have a recording member in the performing group unless you have the trademark. Otherwise, you got to call yourself a tribute or a salute, which is really what these shows are. If you call it a tribute to the Drifters, Coasters, Platters, no harm, no foul, and the public that pays its, plunks down its hard-earned entertainment dollars to go see this show knows what it's actually paying to see. And by the way, tribute shows are cheaper, the tickets are cheaper. You know, what this is a tribute show in sheep's clothing. It's a, unscrupulous people are putting out this show, and it's a sophisticated form of identity theft, really, where they pretend that they are the group, thereby commanding more money from the venue, commanding more money for the tickets, and duping the public while the people who really are the group are sitting at home wanting to work.
Senator Olson, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I, maybe this is just so obvious, Mr. Bauman, but the person I can think of most who's most often comes up with in the music industry is probably Elvis.
But you always know it's not Elvis.
Mr. Bauman.
But I think we all know we're not seeing Elvis. I think most or almost everyone knows they're not seeing Elvis. But these shows are often billed as, you know, usually it's Elvis impersonator, or they make it clear that it's impersonating Elvis.
Yeah, doesn't it?
This isn't going to have any impact on that.
We just saw him.
Zero.
Okay.
No impact whatsoever. Elvis impersonators, I suppose if somebody gets over the line and actually really seriously claims they're Elvis, there could be an issue, but no one's done that so far.
Senator Sparks.
Madam Chair, I would move that House File 1340 be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor, I believe.
Senator Sparks, I believe it's House File. It moves that Senate, House File 1314.
14, thank you.
Be recommended to pass. Any discussion on this, members? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? I'm ahead of myself. I'm sorry. Opposed? The motion prevails. And Mr. Bauman, thank you. I wish you could stay and entertain us more.
Thank you. Thank you.
This will be the most sought-after tape.
It's fun, but it's also a good issue. You know, it's an important issue that we can solve. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I really did see Elvis last year.
Did you? Where?
Yeah. I went to a concert.
Senator Sparks will...
Really?
Chair the...
Blue Moon.
Where's this guy going?
Hey, Madison.
Jim. Where are you going to? You go dancing?
I have it in here.
Senator Scheid, Senate File 2930. Is that what we're...
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's correct. Thank you. First of all, recall that last year we passed legislation regulating for the first time debt management entities, people who help consumers, if you will, or people who have borrowed themselves into debt and are having trouble paying all of their creditors. There are debt management services. I think we have had only, let's see how many, there were 8 licensed nonprofit providers in Minnesota last year. I think we still have that. And, but there are more than 1,000, like 1,200 and some of these entities operating nationwide. So we acted to regulate them within the state of Minnesota. We have a couple of issues that arose. One arose on the effective date of the legislation because we neglected to include, and I neglected to know, that there were a couple of other accredited counseling providers, accreditation services, entities that we now require of people doing this business. So we had only named one in our bill last year, and now we are adding, with this language in 2930, 2 additional entities that do accreditation. And we are actually doing something on page 2, which we don't often do, but because this was so, this ended up being a very disruptive piece of our bill last year when we, because we had other entities who were doing business in Minnesota, they had clients in Minnesota, and all of a sudden they weren't going to be allowed to do business with them. We have grandfathered them in. So on page 2, you'll see on line 24 and 25, we are saying they need to show proof of accreditation unless they were licensed as a debt prorater immediately before August 1 of 2007, which was obviously the effective date of last year's bill. And Mr. Ron Elwood is here. Is there? Just to say, we are now requiring an annual report, and on page 4 at the top, the first 4 lines are new language, and we are asking for these registrants who are registered with the Department of Commerce to file a report with the commissioner about whatever the commissioner requires about their preceding calendar year. So, and the commissioner will prescribe the form of that. Mr. Elwood, do you want
to? Mr. Elwood, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Just a couple of quick things to thank Senator Scheid for bringing the bill forward and doing some of this housekeeping that we found out that we needed to do after we passed this great bill last year, and also to acknowledge and thank the Minnesota Department of Commerce and their staff for working through this and making sure that the folks that were doing good business could continue to do business until we were able to do these technical corrections this year. So I want to appreciate the Department of Commerce.
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
Senator Scheid.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, there may be some other people here, I think, that wanted to speak to it. Yes.
Is there John Hoffman?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
State your name for the record and proceed.
My name is John Hoffman. I'm from Champlin, Minnesota. And I am here on behalf of the American Association of Debt Management Organizations. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Hoffman from Champlin. I'm here on behalf of Mark Guyman, who's the Executive Director of the American Association of Debt Management Organizations. And I have copies of the notes, and they're just 2.5 pages long. It's going to take me about 2 hours, Chair.
Well, you have about 2
I'm
minutes.
Kidding.
You don't have 2 hours.
5 minutes.
You have 5 minutes.
I'm kidding. My wife told me not to be funny. So.
And I think everybody has a...
Oh, can you give one? The American Association of Debt Management Organizations, also known as AADMO, is the largest trade association for the credit counseling industry. Nationwide, the majority of licensed and legally operating credit counseling agencies are members of AADMO. AEDMO is the only trade association to have held state law compliance workshops with the New York State Banking Department and the California Department of Corporations upon enactment of their respective laws that govern credit counseling. AEDMO is also the only trade association for the industry to publish a formal summary of state laws that have been reviewed by state regulators. The first part of the testimony is just focuses on the amendment to the word accreditation. And there's only three items that we just wanted to bring forward to the committee to possibly correct. And I want to thank Chairwoman Scheid, Madam Chairwoman Scheid, for her willingness to last year listen to our concerns as an organization and to hold this bill today. The first part of the testimony is on accreditation. Currently, the president proposes Section 1, supplement Section 332A, Subdivision 2. It says accreditation means certification as an accredited credit counseling provider by the Council of Accreditation, the Bureau of Veritas Quality International, or BSI Management. The first observation you want to note is Bureau of Veritas Quality International changed its name years ago to Bureau Veritas Certification, and therefore BVQI may not be appropriate as named entity. Our proposed change to this language is extremely straightforward, and what we do is it names the current providers, but it provides the commissioner full authority to add providers without the need to enact a new law every time. The debt management law that the bill seeks to amend provides the commissioner the authority to engage in rulemaking. The commissioner should be permitted through rulemaking to approve accreditation organizations. Several states have recently enacted laws requiring accreditation, and all have foregone a static fixed list and have instead allowed for a dynamic list that is responsive to the market to be developed by the respective regulatory authority. We propose quite simply that the existing amendment continue with the addition of or any other entity approved by the commissioner. So the full text, do you want me to read it, or are you okay with it in front of you?
We're all right.
Thank you. In addition to our testimony about the amendments of the new law, we believe that the legislature has an opportunity to change two other provisions of the new law that are somewhat problematic. The law requires a provider to notify a debtor in each and every instance when a creditor refuses to participate in the debt management plan. The section reads, Subdivision 7 on your proposed bill is the withdrawal of a creditor. Whenever a creditor...
I don't think you have to read.
We're okay?
They all have
all right.
This in front of them so you see
we
that.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Let me just summarize that. Thank you, Madam Chair. That's fine. The change there is that it's just unreasonably and unnecessary for a credit counseling agency to notify the consumer with each rejection. What happens a lot of times is the credit card companies will put their I's and cross their T's, and if for some reason you missed a pay date or you were one day off, they'll reject it. That's as matters picking up the phone and saying, well, we gave power of attorney and we missed the date, we're going to move it back, and then they'll be fine with that. So a lot of those are fixed. Those are fixable. Those are fixable corrections that occur, and that happens daily. The other piece that I want you to take a look at is the Act requires that fees be reasonable. Right now, as a nonprofit, you're able to get a fair share of the funds available in a plan, and that all creditors get paid, you know, equal an opportunity there. And in the fair share portion, the credit card companies, for example, Citicard rates Consumer Credit of Des Moines is one of the highest and most in their rating, as far as they get 86% after a year actually get debt-free within that five-year period. So there's some good notes there. Fair share portion is the credit card company will pay back to the nonprofit a percentage, not to ever increase 15%. If you don't have the fair share in there, nonprofits are going to have to force themselves to charge larger fees to the consumers who are already strapped with debt. And we know that that's a problem here in the state. So I would like to see that prohibitions actually in Section 19. We recommend that the provisions applying the prohibition to other than a nonprofit corporation be stricken, and that, you know, the fair share language be added back in. And with that, I'll stand because the information's in front of you.
Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, on the last point, I think that what we have in the law we enacted last year was that the nonprofits would be able to get a fair share. That would only the nonprofits.
Yep.
Not the. So I'm not sure that I didn't understand what you said to be that, but
excuse me.
That's what we intended.
So that's covered? Is that already?
Mr. Chairman, I guess not. I don't know.
Okay.
With what he said doesn't match with what I'm reading. At least what I heard, I should say, not necessarily what he said, but what I heard.
Can I,
Mr. Elwood, did you kind of hear? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I heard the same, and I think Senator Scheid has said it, we've allowed the nonprofits to obtain the fair share, which is precisely what the intent was last year.
Well, are we clear, or is that that's the question? Or what?
No, Mr. Chairman, I think because the debtor, the client, if you will, is paying for the service. I mean, there is a fee to the debt management service.
Correct.
That's being collected by them. But I don't know. I think that the nonprofits, I don't know if they charge a fee, but they're getting some kind of fair share back once the debts are paid. Is that right?
So they get some remuneration somewhere or another. Mr. Hoffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Secretary. Oh, my order.
Oh, you're fine.
Sure, I can wait.
See, you were wrong twice. You called me Madam Chair, and you called me Your Honor. But that's all right.
Do you know?
You can still visit with us.
It's kind of a demotion.
You go to court.
Sorry to hear.
Is that a demotion or?
I'm blowing it. What we have is, if you look at the last page of the handout I gave you. Is that my understanding is that the language that you have currently listed only allows the nonprofit to collect the money from the debtor. There is a fair share provision in that says, you know, you have to also go back to the credit. You should be able to go to the credit card companies and say, we're creating a win-win here. You're getting your debts paid in full, and the debtor is paying their debts off in full, therefore we would like a portion. They give a percentage back, and that never exceeds more than 15%. So what we did is added a line, except from a creditor of the debtor, which is under Section 19.
So,
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I had understood that the association generally supports what we're doing.
Yes.
And so I'd like to move the bill. I thought that the chairman himself might have had an amendment.
Yeah, I was looking for Councilor Bob Hinches. This is the A3 amendment that deals with Subdivision 5, modifications of existing agreements. And I think this was run by Mr. Elwood at Legal Aid, and I would like to hope if there's an agreement, we'll add it today, but I think we ought to talk about it because it does belong in this committee, and I know you have one more stop, but if he can convince the committee that this should go on, we'll do it here, otherwise we'll work on it a little bit longer. Welcome, Mr. Hinches.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name's Bob Hinches. I represent CARE One Services, which is a national debt counseling and debt management company. The CARE One does support strong debt management laws around the country. The language passed last year creates a couple of problems for CARE One's operations and presumably the operations of others. So we are suggesting in this amendment some tweaks to make Care One and others' operations more efficient and effective, follow the usual business practice, and most important, help consumers. The two exceptions from the two signatures requirement for modifications of an agreement. There are one is changes that are requested by the debtor, and that might be to add or delete a creditor, and it might be to voluntarily increase payments. But again, these are requested by the debtor. And the second area is two signatures not required when there are increases that are required by the by a creditor because some incomplete or inaccurate information has been supplied by the debtor. That's usually a situation where it's out-of-date debt figures, for example. And the reason that we're suggesting these is that, well, I should say that in each case, an updated payment schedule or notification of the change within 7 days is required. The reason that we're suggesting these are, as we know from opt-in, opt-out, anytime you send out something and ask somebody to sign it and return it, very few people do. And the problem for the debtor is that it may miss a payment. The provider may miss a payment. The debtor may miss a payment or fall further behind in paying off his or her debt simply because he forgot or didn't read his mail and didn't send the signature back. And it does increase costs, at least for future consumers. The other two changes, tweaks, relate to the trust account. And the one says that the provider doesn't have to put the debtor's payment into the trust account until the check is cleared the bank, so that the bank doesn't have to debit the account later. And the other one allows providers to take money out of the trust account for payment to the debtor or the creditors, but to sweep all of the payments from all of the accounts into a disbursement fund. And there are efficiencies, obviously, of scale and use of technology in doing that. And what the language of the law that was passed last year says that the payments must be made, or at least implies, they must be paid directly from the trust account to the creditor without this intermediate step that results in efficiencies and effectiveness. So that's what the amendment does, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Scheid. I just wonder about the language on 1.31, and maybe counsel could give us some advice on this. You suggest a change from the moment that they are received, talking about the payments to the moment that the funds are good. And I just wonder if that language is, if there isn't a better, more, less ambiguous way of describing that.
Mr. Chairman, I think, would available be better? I mean, I think bankers, I know what is
available.
Meant by good, but I think available.
Available funds is what.
I think we should
would be the
do that.
Better wording.
If Senator Olson wants to move that.
And are good, yeah. That's
yeah.
Funds are available.
I'd like to make a motion that we delete the word good and substitute the word available. Would that be the appropriate way to handle it?
Yes, that's exactly right. Any discussion on that amendment? All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Discussion on the amendment, Senator Scheid and Mr. Elwood, I think you just got it yesterday, so.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask Mr. Elwood to speak as well, but I thought I'd give my kind of off the top of my head response here to this. We don't want to weaken the protection for the consumer here with these debt management services. We want them not to be kind of jerked around with what the amount might be. We want to know that it's and yet I understand that if you're just saying, look, I want to pay $10 more a month on this account, that you probably don't have to wait for a signature to do that. In this day and age, I suppose that signatures are becoming something less and less used as people are, you know, recorded as they make changes to their account or whatever. When you do that by phone or by, and then certainly, of course, you can do it electronically. But I think that that first language from 114 to 122 is pretty much acceptable. I would be a little concerned about the word voluntarily. I mean, I assume it means that they themselves come up with the idea to increase the amount of the payment. I don't know if we want to work on that word. This bill will go to judiciary, but I just want you to know generally, I mean, I think this is a commerce committee decision about that. But I think that that doesn't really weaken things. I was concerned about the last part, but I think that you're still, I mean, let me make sure that I understand what Mr. Henches is suggesting here and the chairman in the amendment, that the debt service the debt management service is going to still have a separate trust account for that individual debtor.
Yeah.
But when they make the payment to the accounts, to the creditors, they will put the funds from the trust account into a larger account, if you will, a disbursement account. I'd like to ask Mr. Elwood if you know what you think of that. Just kind of
Mr. Elwood.
Not run here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As a general matter, you know, the intent of this legislation last year was to in fact actually level the playing field for providers all across the country, make sure everybody's operating under the same rules. It was never an intent to fence anybody out, the out-of-state companies. On the other hand, we were trying to address some abuses that, well, serious abuses that were kind of rampant in this arena. So what I simply say at this point, since we really just got this yesterday, I've sent it around to some of the folks that we worked with last year who actually provide these services in Minnesota, Lutheran Social Services, Catholic Charities, those folks, and some of the other folks that are expert in working in the field. And while I'm sure the intentions are really good on this bill, I guess I'd like to make, before we sign off completely, I'd certainly like to hear back from those folks to make sure that there are no unintended problems or unanticipated issues that I can't see sitting here having just seen it. So I think that's kind of where we're at the moment. But I know that Senator Scheid is committed to maintaining the strong consumer protections that we put in last year. So I'm simply going to defer to her judgment as to where she wants to proceed today.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be generally supportive of these changes in as much as they, you know, don't do damage to the consumer protection. They still allow a responsible company, an agency, to do business in Minnesota and help help clients here. But the bill will be going to the Judiciary Committee. Both Senator Olson and I serve on that. And I'm glad she's here for this discussion, just because I want to say that I don't want to weaken the protections. Generally speaking, it's fine with me if this goes on. It may change a little bit, but I think that generally we're receptive to letting a company operate in this, you know, in this manner. Yes, and Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I just want to be clear, because the only concerns that I would have is to make sure that there's knowing consent to changes. That was a key thing. And if this language does not impair that, that's fine. But I just want to be clear that that's the intent that we want to maintain. And also, last year we wanted to ban the idea of the commingling of all those funds. And again, if the language here doesn't intrude on those principles, then I don't think there's a problem. But I just don't know whether or not they do or they don't, based on, because I haven't just received the analysis from the folks that work on it. So I just want to set those principles forward. Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Scheiden. This is a related but maybe a little bit different question, but just as I was looking at this, and maybe this is addressed somewhere else in statute, but when I was thinking about commingling of funds, that made me wonder what happens to the interest on these accounts. You know, whatever interest is generated on the money that's sitting in these accounts, who benefits from that and who gets it? I just wonder that, because, again, if you're commingling money, then obviously I don't know how you track that interest, but I don't know where it goes already anyway.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Scheiden.
Mr. Chairman, I'm guessing it's not there very long because it's in a trust account, and I don't know. Maybe Mr. Hoffman can speak to this because he's a practitioner. You know, he knows how it works. Could I ask him?
Could you answer that question?
Do you know?
I'll help you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am not so nervous anymore. You know, you'd be surprised what I do for another job. So, receipts and disbursements must occur. You know, the money comes in and it gets dispersed right away. So, if it's going to be in the account, it's probably less than a day that it would be in there. And so, the average of it getting any kind of accrued interest are slim to none. I can get some direct information from our organization to get it to Senator Scheid if you'd like. But it gets. The receipts come in and the disbursement happens right away. They have to do that, actually, in order to get people paid on time.
Well, you know, I think we've had certainly it's up to the author what you want to do with this, but this is, in my opinion, a Commerce Committee issue. This is a Commerce, but we've discussed it quite thoroughly, and normally we'd like to do all of our work here, but I think if the author agrees, and if there's a word or two change, and I think Mr. Hentges, if we leave here with this on, kind of with the understanding that I think Mr. Elwood makes a good point. I mean, he just got this yesterday, and he's got to get to his people and come back, and I think he deserves a chance to be heard in court, so to speak. So I guess we could put it on with the understanding that there might be a little more work to do, or Mr. Elwood might object and worry about it later in judiciary. Is that what?
Mr.
If we're all clear on that, if this committee's comfortable with that, because we want to do our work here, but
Mr. Chairman, no, I think that's fine. I mean, I generally think it's going to be fine, but there may be a tweak or two.
Okay.
And
so, if the committee, are you fine with that? I mean, normally we dot the I's and cross the T's and everything around this committee, but I think on this one, with the understanding, we can move on, and so. I see the heads are nodding. I could make the motion. Give the chair to Senator Johnson. Would you make the motion on this A4A3 amendment? Okay, everybody understands what we're doing. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Any further discussion on the bill, Senate File 2930, as amended?
No, Mr. Chairman, it would be referred then to the Committee on Judiciary.
So Senator Scheid would make that motion to Senate File 2930 be recommended to pass and
as amended
and forwarded to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, folks.
A lot of
work done on this.
And Mr. Chairman, I wanted to share with the committee that Mr. Hoffman is an honored member of the Anoka-Hennepin School Board. So once he decided who you were, he was much more comfortable. It is confusing when you prepare testimony and then I'm not sitting up there, right?
I understand this next bill. You want to take that? It seems Senator Berglund's here, but is this a quick one? I'm told
well,
there should be.
Mr. Chairman, it won't be as long as Senator Berglund's, I think.
Oh, okay. Senate File 3132.
So we do, and I left my watch up there, and I can't.
It's 1:33 and a half.
We have about an hour and a half.
Okay.
We can go till 3.
You don't
There's
have to use it all,
in.
You know.
Me?
We don't have to use all the time, you know.
Oh,
all right, Senator Scheid.
First of all, I'd like to offer the Delete Everything Amendment. It's the A2, I believe.
Okay, this gets the bill in the
that will put it the
shape the author would like
it.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Scheid.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members. This is going to be called the Minnesota Medical Privacy Protection Act, and what it has to do, the private information that's being protected here would be medical debt information on consumers. You know, if I go out and abuse my credit card or even go out and secure a second mortgage to pay off maybe other consumer credit that I have or those kinds of things and I abuse it or I suddenly can't pay and I fall behind, that information obviously is available. But if I get cancer and incur enormous debt, don't have a state health plan, which I do, it's not something within my control. That debt that I incur or that any one of us would incur, that many families are incurring, I think a good share of people are in bankruptcy, as we know, because of medical debt. So this is about protecting that medical debt information, if you will. Now, the Delete Everything Amendment does have the findings and purpose. And I know that this bill will go to Judiciary as well, but I think perhaps Mr. Harrington can tell you why we want to have this in here, and let him explain it in more detail than
Hopefully,
I have.
We usually don't. Maybe they're you know, convince us there's a good reason because we usually don't put in findings and purpose and
Chairman,
bills.
Know.
Mr. Harrington, you want to give a shot at that?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Jeff Harrington. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Minnesota Attorney General's Office, and I first want to thank you for taking up this important bill. With respect to the question of the findings and purpose, I think it's important in this case to have findings and purpose expressed by this body because of the unique nature of the medical debt that Senator Scheid was talking about. I think that the intent expressed in the findings and purpose will make clear what is at issue here and make clear what the aim of the bill is, conversely make clear what the aim of the bill is not. I think it's a chance in which the intent, if this was reviewed by a court, could be clearly expressed and relied upon by a court to ascertain any meaning in the statute.
All right, we'll probably leave it in going out of here. Senator Scheid, do you have further?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Harrington would tell you technically what we're doing here.
Mr. Harrington.
Thank you. I'd like to set up first by talking about the need for this legislation. Recent media reports suggest that the privacy of an individual's medical debt information is under attack. News accounts indicate that a company is developing a service that would compile data on the medical payment histories of individuals and sell that data to healthcare providers to help determine the likelihood that patients will pay their bills. Now, one obvious risk in not protecting the privacy of an individual patient's medical payment history is that the patient may not get the health care that she needs on account of the medical debt that she carries. Indeed, healthcare providers may choose to ration healthcare on the basis of a patient's medical debt. This prospect is a frightening reality for many Minnesotans. In fact, it's no secret that one-third of Americans have problems with medical debt. Even the two-thirds of Americans who have health insurance still have unaffordable deductibles and copays. The experience in Minnesota mirrors this picture nationwide. More than 1 million Minnesotans spend 10% or more of their pre-tax income on health care costs. With the high cost of health care, many Minnesotans are incurring medical debt. This bill in front of you today seeks to solve this pressing problem. This bill is tailored to protect the privacy of medical debt information. Specifically, it regulates those health care providers that provide health care for a fee and are eligible for reimbursement under medical assistance. This bill contains simple, common sense protections for information related to payment history or indebtedness of a patient regarding the health care services provided. So, for example, the Act 1 prohibits health care providers from disclosing an individual patient's financial or medical debt information to another entity, and prohibits health care providers from obtaining or using that information from any entity that gathers, maintains, or distributes individual patient financial or medical debt information until after health care services have been provided to the patient. However, this bill does not prevent health care providers from sharing an individual patient's financial or medical debt information to the patient, to the patient's insurer, to the patient's authorized third-party debt management service, a third-party debt collector that the healthcare provider has contracted with to collect medical debts, or the state or federal government as required by law. In addition, the Delete All Amendment also provides that this bill does not prohibit disclosure of this information to attorneys, accountants, or auditors working on behalf of the medical provider. In sum, this bill provides basic, common sense, truly ground-level protections to level the playing field and protect the privacy and health care of Minnesota patients. The Attorney General asks you to vote in favor of this bill. And with that, I would welcome any questions that the committee may have.
Senator Prettner-Solin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Harrington, is it? I have a question about the top of page 2. A health care provider shall not obtain or use information. And I'm just wondering how that's going to affect hospitals' registration and things like that. Because one of the first things they do is they register a patient before they provide the services. And that's a help to the patient to know that their services are actually covered. They check that out before they're admitted in for services.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Senator, that's a very good question. I don't believe that this bill would in any way inhibit the registration process. I think patients could register for their medical treatment in the way that they have. All this bill does is that it does prohibit the health care provider from obtaining or using medical debt information prior to the completion of treatment.
Mr. Harrington, then debt does not refer to owing for the services at that time?
Harrington.
Mr. Chair, Senator, no, it would not.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, it's pretty clear, I think, that they can't use information that comes from an entity that gathers this information. It wouldn't pertain to what hasn't been done yet.
Okay.
Senator Olson. Wait, Senator Prettner-Solin, are you?
I'm finished.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid. And first of all, thank you so much for bringing this bill forward. I think it's really important that we get a handle on how people's information is being used between creditors, insurance companies, medical providers. This is a very important issue for our times, I think. The question I have is it this does authorize on 2.8 this information to be provided to third-party debt collectors, and I assume that's to help them collect the bills for the hospital. When we've looked at these similar kinds of issues in data practices, the question often comes up, what about that third party's ability then to share that information? So that whenever the information goes out to anyone else, can we restrict, or is there a way of restricting so that once it gets in the hands of debt collectors that they're not selling or providing information that would be going somewhere else? And I know that there are privacy laws that I would think pertain to this information, but I just wonder if there's been any discussion of that or if that's something we need to be concerned about.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's a very good point. This bill doesn't address that issue. This bill is focused on health care providers and their disclosure or use of this information. It's a point well taken that the third-party debt collector that is allowed to have that information, there isn't in this bill any language that would affect that. With regard to have there been any discussions or concerns on that, not that I'm aware of, but it is a concern, and I think that perhaps it might be one that will need to be addressed in the future.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, and that as a it raises an alarm for me, too, or a little red flag. I think that is a subject probably particularly pertinent in the Judiciary Committee where this is going, so I've made note of it. And, I mean, I know we care about this because we've dealt with the Social Security number issue in the same kind of concerns we have about what third parties might do with the information. So I think the Attorney General's office will address that question and be prepared. I'm better prepared to discuss that in Judiciary. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Vandiver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did we adopt the amendment yet?
Yes, we did.
Yeah. And I've read the findings, and I would just soon take them out of the bill. I mean, it's pretty generic. Is this was that the purpose of the amendment, was to get the findings in?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, yes, that, and to take care of a few other issues that had arisen. But the Attorney General's office feels it's important for us, for the legislature, to say that this is why we're doing this. This is of such importance because we, and you'll notice we have a severability clause at the end of the at the end of the bill, and I don't think we're concerned about future actions. We would like, if the court is looking at this, we would like them to see our rationale for enacting it.
I guess. Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, is there going to be any testimony relating to this bill against it, do you know? Or?
Mr. Chairman, I assume the chairman will ask. I don't know.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd wait before I made a motion like that and see how this progresses if that's okay.
Okay, we heard enough about the bill. Is there anybody in the audience wish to come forward and speak against this legislation? Yes, come forward. For or against?
You can speak.
Okay, identify yourselves for the...
Mr. Chair, Dave Renner with the Minnesota Medical Association. I'm not here to testify against the intent of this legislation, but just to raise a question and a concern, and we've not had a chance to... We just saw the amendment. Again, the intent of, I think, what the Attorney General is proposing and Senator Scheid is proposing, we don't oppose. But there is some question about, can a provider get this information from a patient? It talks about any entity that gathers individual patient financial data. There is the, on subdivision 4 on lines 2.5, it talks about nothing prohibits the healthcare provider from sharing individual patient financial data with the patient, but we do have some concerns about, can you gather this data? As an example, a patient who may have a $5,000 deductible product, can you ask about their payment of that deductible ahead of time, and that's just something that we think needs clarification. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Sir, Members Harrington, did you have a response?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I do. Turning your attention to page 2, line 2.1, and where it speaks about the health care provider shall not obtain or use information from any entity that gathers, maintains, evaluates, or distributes individual financial or debt information. I think that that speaks for itself as far as a scenario with an individual patient discussing current treatment options with its provider.
Sir,
Mr. Chair, in all respect, I would argue that a patient is an entity who gathers individual patient financial data. So again, the intent of trying to prohibit the use of medical scoring, we're not opposed to. I just want to—that's just a clarification we think the committee needs to.
Okay, Mr. Harrington.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my one concern with the scenario that is being addressed here is that although we're willing to clarify if need be, but the overriding, I think, purpose of this legislation is to make sure that healthcare providers won't ration healthcare on the basis of debt. That is my overriding concern with opening the door for hospitals to have debt information pre-treatment. But the Attorney General's office is willing to clarify the language and try to come to a compromise.
Mr. Chairman. Senator
Scheid.
And Mr. Chairman, I think that's true. There may be a way to make it clear that that's not what we intend to do here, to prevent the patient themselves from discussing their payment options for the, you know, the current or about to be treatment.
That are there other concerns?
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think we could work on that maybe even the next 10 minutes or something, I hope.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that's also appropriate to be done in judiciary. I really do.
Okay.
I'm not trying to not have the committee do the work, but that I think is something that can be done there as well.
All right. If you're all comfortable, that's fine. But, ma'am, did you try?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council on Healthcare. And I sort of came into this hearing with trying to figure out exactly if there were any concerns about the bill. And so maybe what I'll do is just ask a few questions. We had the same concern as Dave Renner just expressed, that it would somehow keep the doctor from actually being able to ask questions about the person's ability to pay. And we think that healthcare and healthcare financing should always be part of the equation about making healthcare decisions. And so we don't think that this bill should keep that from happening. So we would love to see clarification about that. The other question that I had has to do with why it is defined just for Medicaid, medical assistance for providers that do medical assistance. And then the last thing is, it seems to me that I'm not sure, but whether this bill is trying to keep the databases from being built or just trying to keep restriction on when they can be accessed or the data be shared. So those are just two questions that I have. Thank you.
Mr. Harrington can help with that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, with respect to the first question, why medical assistance, that was simply an existing definition that's already in law that refers to those health care providers that provide health care for a fee and obtain medical assistance. The feeling of the Attorney General's office is that those who accept reimbursement from medical assistance are, in a sense, getting money repaid to them by the state, and it is a particular issue in which the government should properly have oversight over. With respect to the second question, the building of a database or access to data, I think the law actually addresses both points. The first prong being this database, it's the intent of this law to prohibit a healthcare provider from disclosing medical debt information to another entity. So that would, I think, counteract, in one sense, a stream of information for databases. Second, the use of the information in the database. This bill is to prohibit the rationing of healthcare, to, in a sense, prohibit healthcare providers from making health treatment decisions on the basis of the debt load of a patient.
Mr. Chair.
officer.
Ma'am.
Mr. Chair, in reference to those answers, I just want to say that it has always been our hope that healthcare would remain a charitable enterprise and would not always be looking at the bottom line, but that individuals would also feel the need to be paying for the services that they receive. And this is sort of an interesting take on it, and we'll look forward to seeing it in judiciary. Thank you.
Letter also.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to kind of follow up, I appreciate Ms. Brace pointing this out, because with respect to the findings, that first paragraph, I just assume personally that that wasn't in there, and specifically because it does give the misconception that this is only applying to those providers that would accept medical assistance. And I don't think that's what the statutory language says. And the second thing is that I think it kind of sets a bad precedent to make it seem as though we have to explain why we would have the right or the interest in regulating privacy issues related to data. I think we have a responsibility in that area with the Data Practices Act, and we do that a lot anyway. I don't think we have to start saying that we need to justify that as it's because they're accepting state money because accepting medical assistance. So at least that first paragraph of the findings, I would feel should come out.
Section Senator Vandiver, did you wish to move to delete Section 1 of the bill?
Mr. Chair, I think I would, yes. I would make that motion.
I need strong opposition to that. I Senator Marty?
Mr. Chairman, if this is in there for, and I wasn't here for the beginning of the discussion on the bill, if it's in there for legal purposes, I think it's appropriate to have in there. I understand Senator Olson's concern about limiting it to our justification being that we have a right to authority and obligation to regulate providers that accept medical assistance. I think those last few words of there, and maybe therefore the whole first paragraph, is a little troubling to me. But I think the idea of having the explanation for the courts, I mean, we've done that many times before.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
I'd just like to make a motion that we just delete that first paragraph, lines 1.4 through 1.6, if Senator Scheid is receptive to that.
And, Mr. Chairman, I am, and then on line 6, or excuse me, 7, you probably want to take out also.
Yeah.
But you would just start with line 1.7, then. It would still say findings. I think it was subdivision 1, findings. And we just then would begin. We delete everything after the second period on 1.4 through 1.6.
Recognize Senator Vandiver, but did you follow this discussion? Would that be all right?
I did. Are there many? Well, anything we could get out. I think findings are in there because you don't know how to write your bill.
Okay. So we'll.
Is she amending my motion? Is that?
No, you withdrew yours.
Okay. No,
I can do that, Mr. Chair. I will probably.
That's okay. Everybody clear on the Olson motion to delete findings 1.4 to 1.6 and on 1.7 also?
The word also, Mr. Chairman.
Discussion on that amendment. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Discussion on the bill as amended. Senator Vandiver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, do I understand this? Now, this bill, what if you get a judgment against you for medical bills and that can't be reported? Is that, or am I missing something here on the bill?
Mr. Harrington.
In that case. Mr. Chair, Senator, if I understand your question right, if a patient or a consumer had a judgment against it, could that not be reported? I believe the answer is no. It wouldn't be prevented. It could be reported. This bill prevents healthcare providers from disclosing information. If a judgment was duly recorded in the state, I don't believe that this bill would be a barrier to it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, I think I think that would be something important to clear up, but how responsible is this, I wonder? Has other states done this, I guess would be my next question.
Mr. Chair, Senator, to my knowledge, Minnesota would be the first state to enter into this area.
Sounds good. I'd request a roll call on the bill, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Chairman?
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I understand. I think it is it's groundbreaking in that sense. I understand that. But, you know, I think Congress has already said that everybody has the right, for example, to receive emergency medical treatment. We have accepted that policy. We think that's good public policy. My goodness. They don't let hospitals turn people out, turn people away. I think that we don't want to see health care portioned out only to those people who haven't had medical debt before, we don't want to see people who have medical debt denied medical treatment. And that, to me, is the overriding public policy here. I generally... you know, this time I'm erring on the side of the patient and of Minnesotans who find themselves with medical debt and needing care, perhaps for another of their children or whatever. We don't want this hindering that
there will be
access.
A roll call that attorney has a technical amendment.
Mr. Chairman, members, given the Olson Amendment on taking out that reference to medical assistance, there's no reason for that section to be coded in the medical assistance statutes 256 anymore. So I think I'd suggest that be codified in the in 325E.45 as a separate subdivision. And that would also necessitate a change on lines 1.19 and 1.20. The cross-reference there should be section we delete sections 256N.01 to 256N.07 and insert this section.
Okay. Yeah,
Mr. Chairman, the effect of putting it all together in one section. I think it makes more sense given the Olson Amendment.
Oh, we knew that.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank
Senator
you, Mr. Stang.
Olson moves that amendment. All those in favor, so can I be saying aye?
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Further discussion on the bill? Senator Vandiver.
Members, I think this bill is groundbreaking. It's groundbreakingly irresponsible. Certainly some people get into trouble and they have problems with paying their bills. But what this says is it can't be reported. So if I didn't have insurance intentionally and I built up a lot of medical bills, if I understand this bill, they could not be reported to any credit reporting agency, and unless there was a judgment, and the author is not even sure if, in the case of a judgment, whether that would be reported. So I think we need a balance here in protecting patients, but I don't think just because we are reporting their payment history, it means they're not going to get good health. And I think if there's a better way to do this probably than this. But I don't think this benefits the system. And I think it could encourage people not to even get health insurance. And I think there's a lot of potential problems with it. It needs some more study.
Senator Olson, I think we're ready to vote. Senator, did you have a comment?
Well,
go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I was just going to say that in the area where I live, you can go by the Eagles Club on any given weekend, and you'll see that there's a benefit that's happening for someone who's in bankruptcy or facing bankruptcy because of medical bills. These aren't people who are irresponsibly choosing not to pay their bills or irresponsibly failing to get insurance. These are simply people, many of them, who had insurance. In fact, most of them probably had some type of insurance, and yet the part that isn't covered is causing them to face bankruptcy. I don't think they need to have their credit destroyed on top of the issues that they're already facing over something that they had no control over, and I think that I'd be proud of Minnesota for taking a leadership stand on this issue.
Yes.
Senator Scheid renews her motion that Senate File 3132, as amended, be recommended to pass and forward it to the Judiciary Committee. Secretary will take the roll.
Senator Scheid?
Yes.
Senator Dahl?
Yes.
Senator Doyle? Senator Johnson?
Yes.
Senator Marty?
Yes.
Senator Metzen?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Senator Kretner Solin?
Yes.
Senator Scogin? Senator Spark?
Yep.
Senator Vandeveer?
No.
Okay. On an 8-1 vote, the bill is passed and forwarded to the Judiciary Committee.
Chairman, members, thank you. And now we'll
get Senator,
Senator Berger.
Got Senate File 3098, Minnesota Health Insurance Exchange.
99, excuse me. I
almost
thought I was in the wrong room.
Senator Berglund, welcome to the committee, and I see you have your trusted sidekick, Senator Rosen, with you, and you may sit down and visit with the committee about this Senate File 3099.
He's across the hall.
Yeah.
John?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. First of all, we do have a handout. Second of all, before we go into describing the bill, we have a technical amendment if someone would like to offer it. It's an 814 amendment.
Senator Olson, could you offer the A14? It's technical. I mean, it's not really an author's amendment. On the other hand, it looks extremely technical. So,
sure. Madam Chair, I haven't seen it, but I'm sure I'll be happy to offer it.
Senator Olson moves the A14 amendment. Are there any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, due to the time and other factors here, we thought we'd just focus on the major part of the bill that is brought the legislation to this committee. And that is the insurance exchange. And unless you have other things you want us to go over, but we thought we'd focus on that.
Just let me ask. I know you told you advised us on what we should be looking at here.
Madam Chair, I think the committee's main area of jurisdiction, as Senator Berglund indicates, the establishment of the health insurance exchange and the reference to the Section 125 plans, how they work together. There's some establishment of commissions in here which are tasked with doing things that affect health plan companies and require implementation of certain things. So you may want to look at that or think about that as well.
Okay. Senator Berglund, we really have to, we have till 3 or a little more. We can, I mean, well, some people would have to leave at 3.
So I'm just going to make some general comments and then we'll let Senator Rosen go into a little more detail, and then I'll follow up after she's done. This is the product of work that was done by the Healthcare Access Commission this summer and the Governor's Task Force on Healthcare Transformation. And the insurance exchange is an item that was considered by both groups. The advantage of having an insurance exchange in Minnesota is that it will allow individuals who do not have employer-sponsored insurance to be able to get a 125 benefit when they purchase their insurance. And that would mean that the money they spend on their insurance premium and deductibles, et cetera, would be done on a pre-tax basis. It makes the insurance much more affordable, anywhere from a 20% to 50% reduction in what the price otherwise would be. We also know from our work that there are quite a few businesses, small businesses, that do offer coverage to their employees, but who also do not take advantage of the 125 provision in the tax law. and this exchange would provide them an easier mechanism to administer that benefit and thereby make the health insurance, the portion their employees pay, more affordable to them as well. So that's the reason that this is in the bill. The 125 benefit draws down $4 to $5 federal dollars for every $1 that has to be spent by Minnesota's budget. And so it is a mechanism in the bill that helps us to achieve more affordability for more people.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Welcome to our committee, Senator
Thank
Rosen.
You. First time this year. So as Senator Burton said, the basic idea of the exchange is as similar to a stock exchange or a farmer's market, where it serves as a market clearinghouse. And there's no single place where an individual or a small employer can go to find statewide to find information on the range of choices that are available to them in the insurance market and easily sort through it and try to understand it. So by providing the single place where people can go to find about their health insurance options, it improves market competition among health plans by providing more complete and understandable access to information about the products and pricing. The health insurance exchange is needed.
You know, I want to let members know exactly where we are in the bill so that members can be
Section
looking.
Section 13?
Page 43. Page 43 of the bill, members. So that's the language that describes the insurance exchange. So you can continue here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The responsibilities of the exchange would be to educate, to do outreach and technical assistance related to health insurance options and, as Senator Burton said, the Section 125 plan. It would develop the state-of-the-art tools to help consumers navigate the market. It would provide online, telephone, written, and in-person assistance to consumers and the employers. It would provide information and enrollment assistance to people who may be eligible for public programs. And it would act as a payment aggregator for funds withheld from employee paychecks under the Section 125 plan and the transmit of the payments to the health plans. That's a very important piece. It would take care of all that for the employers. The exchange is governed by 11 members.
Senator Rosen, excuse us. Senator Johnson, you have a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry to interrupt at this juncture, but what you just said is going to cost some money, some administrative costs. How are they worked into it?
Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Johnson. The initial startup fee for this is $9 million, I believe. And then there is an assessment on the premiums, too. But right now, there is a $9 million.
Madam Chair, and Senator Rosen, I don't want to jump way ahead in the game. What you just said is going to cost some money to administer.
There would be some startup funds that would be provided by the state of Minnesota.
And there's a little
bit of Johnson here.
On the premium. Okay.
And after that, there'd be a small assessment on the insurance policy's premium in order to pay the administrative costs of the exchange.
Senator Vandeveer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if it matters since we don't even have to pay our copays anymore. But the question
Senator Vandeveer, that's not true.
Oh, well, why would I? But anyway, looking at this 0.5%, would you consider that a fee, a tax, or a?
I would consider it an administrative fee.
And
Senator Vandeveer,
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I understand. Who are you assessing to pay this? What plans would be paying this fee?
Senator Berglund or Senator Rosen?
Senator Rosen.
Well, my understanding is it would be the individual and the small group market, because those are the organizations that would be eligible to use the exchange.
Okay, Senator Rosen, did you want to continue?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The exchange is governed by 11 members, the Commissioners of Commerce, Human Services, and Health, 2 from the Senate, 2 from the House, and 4 from the Governor's choice. The exchange is not the only place where policies are sold. There would be no price difference between what is sold inside the exchange and outside the exchange. And the brokers could receive commission in and out of the exchange. this is not, the question sometimes comes up, is this government bureaucracy? The exchange is established as a nonprofit organization outside of state government and is governed by a board of directors, much like the MCHA is today. The exchange is intended to make the health insurance more navigable and understandable for all people, regardless of whether they purchase coverage inside or outside of the exchange. That is, the information and tools developed by the exchange benefit the entire market. The exchange will provide assistance to employers to offer Section 125 plans, whether or not their employees enroll through the exchange. There's also a the bill also allows for a guaranteed issue window. And this establishes a one-month guaranteed issue window for certain people in Minnesota. The guaranteed issue window would apply to those people who buy an individual market health plan through Section 125. These are the only people to whom the guaranteed issue window applies. Today, some employers are not offering insurance coverage and would like to provide a small contribution, say $100 per month, for the employees to buy individual coverage. Other employers are currently offering coverage but may wish to go into a defined contribution environment. If they contribute these funds pre-tax to a Section 125 plan for the purposes of the employees buying individual coverage, federal law may construe that contribution to mean the employer is establishing a group plan. And federal non-discrimination laws say that group plans cannot deny coverage to a single member of a group and must not vary premiums based on certain factors. The guaranteed issue window allows for employees of businesses who do not offer coverage to provide pre-tax contribution to their employees while not running afoul of federal law.
I might just add, Madam Chair, that the bill also allows the policies to have pre-existing condition exclusions in them for a period of time to make sure no one is buying the policy just to use it for a given situation and then drops it. If they know they have a health condition, the policy may require that you have coverage for a certain number of months before you can use it for a pre-existing condition.
Senator Vandeveer, did you have a question?
Not right now, thank you.
Oh, okay. I thought you were signaling me that you wanted to. I guess I have a question. This will be available to people, individuals, and
small groups.
And what about people in MCHA now? Or people in Minnesota care. Did I miss you telling me that already?
No, Madam Chair, I was just going to get to that.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. And your concern is about MCHA enrollees would come into this individual market. But they estimate that there's only about 17.5% of the MCHA enrollees could meet the criteria for this guaranteed issue. It's unlikely that all these enrollees would choose to go through the guaranteed issue window, and so this would be an upper-end estimate, they say. The actual number is probably substantially smaller.
The actual MSHA policies themselves would be sold through the exchange so that people could get the benefit of the 125 tax advantage. And those who are at or above 200% of poverty in Minnesota care would also be able to go through the exchange to get the same tax benefit if they are with an employer that is offering the 125 benefit.
Okay, thank you. That helps.
But this would also allow, Madam Chair, some other people that have not been able to be insured to come into this, and that would be such as the young adults and anybody else who hasn't had that plan. So if I could go on to the Section 125, what that is, and that refers to the Internal Revenue Code. And this bill requires that employers 10 or larger establish Section 125 plan for their employees so their employees can use their pre-tax dollars to pay for the insurance coverage. So,
and this is covered on page 48 of the bill. We're looking at Section 125 plans. Is that?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
It's 1 year of a window after the exchange is established when just providing information to employees about 125 benefits is all that's required. And then in January of 2010, employers of 11 or more are required to offer the 125 benefit, so that their employees, if they, you know, when they don't have insurance, could get that tax benefit in terms of purchasing their own coverage.
Okay. Senator Rosen?
Yes, Madam Chair. The impact for the employer with the with the 125 plan is it's financial, and the employers do not pay Medicare, Social Security, or unemployment insurance taxes on the amounts that employees choose to have withheld from their paychecks on a pre-tax basis. It's relatively inexpensive, and it's estimated to be $300 to $400. So if just a few employees choose to enroll, it's still there is a net financial gain for them. The impact for the individual, of course, is they get to use their pre-tax dollars to buy insurance, and they can save about they can save about on their health insurance about 30 to 50% of the cost of health insurance with the Section 125. And as far as the impact on state revenues, is there is going to be an impact, but it's going to be minor. It'll probably hit more on the federal side of it, because 80% of the revenue impact would be on the federal government.
And any impact would be paid for out of the health care savings offset that is in the bill in a different section.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize. I have a few questions I wanted to ask, and I have to leave before the end of our committee hearing, so I appreciate having the chance to ask them now. I'm wondering, first of all, what you were just talking about. Obviously, the one Section 125 advantage isn't really it may be saving an individual person money, but it's not reducing any costs in care. What it's doing, I think, is shifting those costs to the federal government level as far as tax costs. So I guess I'm wondering, has there been any communication with the federal government? Is anyone else doing this, or is there a possibility that we could spend a lot of money setting something up and then have the federal government turn around and kind of close this window so that, you know, that benefit goes away in terms of a tax benefit? So that's one question I have.
Senator Berglund?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, Insurance Exchange has been created in the state of Massachusetts and Connecticut, and one's been authorized and is being established in the state of Washington. So we have no reason to believe that this wouldn't be a legal opportunity for us to establish an insurance exchange and provide our citizens with the benefit of 125.
And Madam Chair, currently
Senator Rosen.
Employers can provide a 125 plan. Now we're going to require them.
Senator Olson?
But this is also, Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, going to extend to the individual market too as well, right? So we are going to be putting this in play for something that has never been maybe contemplated at the federal level before, or isn't that the case?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Olson, the federal
Burton.
Government is fully aware of what's been done in the state of Massachusetts. They had federal waivers on many parts of their plan, and so if there was going to be any problem with establishing it, it would have come up before now.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In terms of the assessment on insurance policies, and you said a small assessment, I'd like to know if there's an indication on a percentage basis, perhaps, what that assessment's going to be, because I think there are a number of costs that seem to be going to the individuals that are going to increase costs for purchasing policies in the individual and small business market. And I know that there's a contemplation that there are going to be savings by setting this up that are going to offset those costs. But for some people who are concerned about whether those savings are actually going to come about, I'm wondering, you know, if we could know exactly what we're going to be adding to the costs of these policies. So we can weigh that.
Senator Rosen or
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, the assessment is 0.5%.
Of the premium.
Was it? Did someone on the committee ask a question? Oh, Senator Vandiver wanted to know. 0.5% of the premium. Okay.
And, Madam Chair,
Olson.
I noticed at the outset of this there's also a cost or a fee or something that talks about a public health, some public health programs we're putting into play. And it seems from some of the information that we're getting that it may be that the ERISA plans are not, and certainly not the government plans, aren't going to be sharing those costs. And since public health has usually been something that we pay for, everyone pays at the state level, is that going to be another fee that's going to fall primarily to the small business and individual market, kind of transferring that cost of public health to that market?
Senator Berger.
Madam Chair, that's a part of the bill that really isn't within the jurisdiction of this committee, but it would be an assessment that would be charged to nonprofit hospitals and not-for-profit health plans and would be in place for 5 years to start the public health investment program. And those hospitals that meet that obligation would be considered to have met their public reinvestment responsibility as a not-for-profit.
Right, members, we do want to concentrate on the pieces of the bill that that where we have some jurisdiction, or we have jurisdiction. We're going to be done at 3 o'clock, and a lot of people have asked to testify.
So I would suggest
I wonder, I think that it's probably time to do that. I think we understand what the exchange and the Section 125 plans or that option, well, it wouldn't be an option anymore, but that availability for employers. So I want to say I know a lot of people have asked to testify, and I am sorry that some people had the impression that we couldn't take anymore. The truth of the matter is we knew we wouldn't have time to have everybody give duplicative testimony. So I'm going to ask people to come up kind of four at a time, I think. I think we have four chairs up there. And I don't know if you have people to testify for this, Senator Berglund. Mm. Is there anybody that wanted to testify for the bill?
Madam Chair, we have people here from the administration to help us answer questions.
Okay.
And, you know, but we didn't want to take up a lot of time.
No,
so.
And Senator Berglund, no, I appreciate that. So I'd like the people then who have signed up.
And we do have the handout.
Okay.
Okay,
we will. She's looking for some members right now, but we'll get that. I'm going to. I have some people listed. There were some other people that did, that wanted to. I know the Council of Health Plans. Through the executive director, Julie Brunner has put a goldenrod colored sheet of paper here for members. I think that some of the questions that have been asked already may be on point that they were making in that letter. I'll certainly let anybody have an opportunity to speak. Everybody has an opportunity to speak, but it's really going to be condensed, if you will. And on the matter of the exchange and on the Section 125. So, Mr. Sposetto.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Everybody just identify yourselves and before you speak, and then we'll...
I'm Dominic Sposetto. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Independent Insurance Agents and also the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, two associations that represent agents and brokers in Minnesota. I would like to first off say that the exchange that we are looking at today is a far sight better than the exchange that we discussed here last year. I want to commend Senator Berglund and Senator Rosen, the governor's office, for listening to the concerns that the insurance agents and brokers brought to them, and they made some rather significant changes to this year's version of the exchange. For example, it is now no longer mandatory, it is optional for employers to participate in the exchange, which maintains both the private market and the ability for agents to work with the exchange. And the role of agents was greatly expanded over the last year's proposal, and we think that's very valuable if this exchange is going to succeed. It's very important that agents and brokers are involved. Since many of our concerns have been addressed, we're no longer strongly opposed to the exchange. However, before we can totally support this proposal, we still have some concerns that need to be worked out as this bill advances. First and foremost is the issue of the employer mandate for 10 or more employees. That particular segment of the market really has a lot of insurance coverage already. There are a lot of 125 plans available to this particular market, and any of them who are working closely with agents have probably been already advised about the ability to create a 125 plan. But I know there are others here that are going to be more specific about the employer mandate, and I thought I'd get more into the insurance side of the equation. Another concern we have is that it looks like the insurance exchange will offer small employer products as well as the individual products and the Section 125 plans, which we view as individual products because they are individually applied for and approved by the exchange. So we're concerned that maybe we might be biting off a little more than we could perhaps chew and maybe just focus on the individual side of the equation with individual products and 125 plans. We're encouraged that all insurers are required to participate in the exchange. The question is how many plans will be available, and I think that's an important question. We want to have enough plans available through the exchange to make it attractive for people to purchase. On the other hand, we don't want to have so many products available through the exchange that it gets confusing and time-consuming and raises concerns in everyone's mind about what exactly we're doing. And I don't know where the happy medium is there. I think we can discuss that as it goes forth. I'm pleased to see that all agents are available to write products through the exchange, and I think we need to discuss how that actually would work in practice. Take, for example, a company like Federated Insurance that writes through its own agents, its own agent force, that will be required to offer products through the exchange. If all agents are available to write products through the exchange, that would mean that an agent that is not necessarily an employee of Federated would be able to write a Federated product. I don't know if that is good or bad, and I think in order to make that actually work, there may be a requirement that agents actually be appointed by the exchange as well as the companies that they write with. But that's something I think we need to explore as this goes forth. Another major concern we have is the question of the guarantee issue for the 125 plans. The proposal suggests that the plans inside the exchange will be the same as those sold outside the exchange in terms of pricing, in terms of benefits and such. But if we offer a guaranteed issue product within the exchange and we don't offer it outside the exchange, it creates a possibility, and I don't know to what extent this is valid, but a possibility of an adverse selection for those people who want a guaranteed issue product to go through the exchange. Now, perhaps that's not bad, but I think in the long run that may affect the ability of the exchange to price its products and to deliver that product efficiently. I think that's something we need to discuss. I have talked to Senator Berglund and the Health Department, and they have told me that this is something they feel they need to comply with federal law to allow this to go forth. And to be honest, I'm not an expert on the federal requirements for group insurance, and it's something that I think we should look into. But it is a concern that we have, and we think it might be detrimental to be offering guaranteed issue products within the exchange. There is a provision for the guaranteed issue that exempts employees and employers who decide to waive the coverage after being informed by an insurance agent and informed and educated by an insurance agent about the exchange and the 125 plans. And I think that's a very good proposal. It would allow an agent to explain the situation, and once the employer understands, they could choose to opt out of the guaranteed issue provision. The concern I have is that that provision sunsets in January 1st, 2010. And my sense is if it's a good idea, maybe it's a good idea beyond that sunset period. Again, I don't know if this is the federal issue that we're dealing with, but I think from a practical standpoint, if people are have an opportunity to understand that the exchange is available, to look outside the private market or outside the exchange market in the private market for products, I think this idea of a waiver should be valid for as long as we can use it. Last, I'd like to say that there's an opportunity here to use insurance agents and producers to help with the Minnesota Care program. Many agents have talked to people who obviously qualify for this program, and we know a significant number of the uninsured will qualify for the Minnesota Care program, but agents are not able or have the understanding or the patience to go through the Minnesota Care enrollment process. And we're hoping that there would be a way that we could address that to allow agents to assist people in being enrolled in Minnesota Care and be duly compensated for their efforts. We think that would be very helpful. So with that, we hope to continue to work with Senator Berglund, Senator Rosen, the Governor's Office, the Health Department as this moves forward. Our concerns are hopefully things that can be addressed. And with that, Madam Chairman, I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Mr. Sposetto, thank you. Clearly, your clients want to be part of the discussion, and I think they have been. It sounds like you have been and are willing to continue to do that. I mean, I don't want to say this is just a work in progress, but, I mean, it is an experiment, if you will, in trying to get more people covered, because at the end of the day, it should cost us less. Certainly individuals in terms of the quality of their lives and their families' lives, but also as taxpayers, I think that what we're doing here is a really critical step, and someday we have to take it. Someday we have to take the first step, and I think that's what Senator Berglund and Senator Rosen are trying to encourage us to do here, but I appreciate everybody's willingness to share your concerns and also the things that you like. So with that, welcome to our committee.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Senators, for allowing me to testify today. My name is Steve Elan, and I'm with Holland & Frank, Executive and Employee Benefits up in Sartell, Minnesota. I've worked in the employee benefit market for over 12 years. One thing, I do completely oppose the Minnesota Health Exchange. I did speak with the governor last Thursday night about the exchange, and hopefully he'll allow me some more time to talk with him. And the reasons for that are that we already have the tools available that the exchange is proposing or the tools that they think are going to help consumers in Minnesota to have more access to health insurance coverage and to reduce cost. I currently work with third-party administrators that on the individual level, as well as small employers and large employers, offer cafeteria, flex, Section 125 plans. They're all the same thing, just different name for it, to allow the pre-taxability of individual health insurance, small group health insurance, as well as in the large group market. One of the things that I did bring up to the governor is I think instead of looking at it from the sense of we need to create this exchange, what we need to do on the federal and state level is just pass legislation that allows the pre-taxability for health insurance, period. There's no reason to set up the exchange. I have heard from the senators here as far as we need a place for individuals in the state of Minnesota, one place where they can go get information in order to be able to purchase insurance. If they go out on the internet or anywhere, they could Google health insurance, and I'm sure my website would pop up towards the top. I'm very informed in the group and individual market. I do work with all people on their insurance. I do offer all different options to them, whether it's Blue Cross, Medica, Preferred One, Health Partners, Assurant. I give them all the options. As far as creating a health insurance exchange, if one of the reasons for trying to create the exchange is to reduce the amount of uninsured in Minnesota, I don't believe that will do anything for reducing the amount of uninsured. Most employers that have over 11 employees or more do have coverage in Minnesota. We are a state that has the highest insured rate in the country, and it's missing the target of the small employer, the 1 to 10 employer market, that's really struggling to get coverage. And some of those are fortunate enough to contact my office, and I can lead them through the education process, utilizing individual high-deductible health plans where I see average savings of 35 to 50% for people on their health insurance, as well as utilizing health savings accounts, and they can fund those on a pre-tax basis. So I don't see that. I've also heard reference to Massachusetts and how they've done this and it's been a success. I have followed what's happened in Massachusetts, and I would far from call that a success. They've had huge overruns in costs. They've had mandates in there mandating that employers have to have insurance for their employees. So I would hate to see in the state of Minnesota that we would put mandates in. I do think, thankfully, the proposed legislation has changed from what it looked like last year, mandating everything in there. But I just don't see any reason for it. The other thing is, you know, right now with just the creation of the exchange, just the idea of creating the exchange, I feel will lead to eventual mandates, which we don't need in this state. Anytime we add on additional mandates in the insurance market, it does not decrease the cost of insurance. And if I can find anyone here that could testify to the fact that costs go down with more mandates, I'd like to hear it.
Well, Mr. Elin, what we've been trying to do is to get a quantification of what they cost, what mandates cost, because we deal with, you know, we have a number of mandate proposals that come before us all the time. Senator Berglund?
Madam Chair, this bill does not mandate people have insurance, so I think it'd be a mistake to get off on that.
Right, okay. Right. So, okay. And we certainly understand that you don't like the exchange.
Okay, great. So, you know, we already have the tools out there available to people to be able to use 125 plans. I think it would be advantageous if we look down the avenue of off from the cafeteria or 125 flex plan. We have the premium only portion of those plans, so you don't have to pay in order to have that administrated. If it could just be legislated federally and in Minnesota that anyone that has health insurance coverage on the group side, it's running through their cafeteria plan, but on the individual and small employer market, if individuals in Minnesota could just have a line item on their tax statement for what they've paid towards their premiums and be able to deduct it. It, to me, seems to make more sense than setting up an exchange and creating more of a I hate to use the term bureaucracy for this, but that's how I feel on it. And then as far as having a health insurance crisis, or hopefully the exchange will take care of that, we do have the tools available. I did a 50,000-piece mailer to people that are either in between jobs, recent college graduates, in order to get we have short-term medical coverages in Minnesota while they're in transition from employer group plans to either getting their own individual coverage or moving to another employer plan. But by utilizing individual high-deductible insurance and allowing people to own those policies, when they have them for life. And there is no one in Minnesota that can't get health insurance coverage. We do have the Minnesota Comprehensive Health already set up if due to health reasons they can't get coverage. And in basic underwriting through any of the carriers, if they qualify, they'll get a standard underwritten plan. So,
Mr. Elin, I think we're concerned. I mean, we know that it's available. We just don't know if people can afford it. And that's a primary concern.
Well, and so what I'm wondering is with the creation of a health insurance exchange, how is that going to bring costs down? Somehow, someone's going to have to be subsidizing the cost to bring it down.
Senator Berglund.
Well, Madam Chair, there are other parts of the bill that bring costs down. We project over, by 2015, a reduction of about 20% of what the costs otherwise would have been. But again, that's not within the purview of this committee. In addition to bringing the cost down, the 125 benefit would make people have more money in their own pocketbook to pay for their insurance.
Right. Senator Berglund, but it is the concern relates to, though, the exchange, which is in the purview. I mean,
right.
So I,
right. Right. But to say this bill doesn't reduce costs is not correct. Right. Okay. It will reduce overall health care costs. In addition to that, it gives people this tax benefit that allows them to have more money of their own to purchase insurance with. The fiscal note on the bill last year showed that once it's fully implemented over a two-year period, they expected 9,000 more people to have insurance that otherwise wouldn't have been insured at all. And obviously there would be other people that would have insurance today but are struggling to pay for it or maybe don't have as good a coverage as they would like if they had the benefit. And those people also would be able to come into the exchange.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Heitzman, welcome to our committee. It's nice to see you.
Thank you.
And I'm going to ask you to be more brief than these other two gentlemen, even though they were very informative and helpful. I'm just going to ask everybody from now on to try just bring it down. We have 17 minutes.
Okay. My name is Darcy Heitzman. I'm an attorney, and my area of practice is employee benefits. I am the author of the ERISA Health and Welfare Manual, which is published by Thompson Publishing. I'm also a national speaker for that same organization on cafeteria plans, which are Section 125 plans. I'm also a small business owner that could potentially be impacted by this bill. And just for the record, this is a passion of mine. I'm here, and no one's paying me to be here. I am here to speak against the mandate on the Section 125 plan. It's the mandate reflected in what would be 62 cap U.03 beginning on page 48 at line 48.7. Section 125 plans are a creature of the Internal Revenue Code at the federal level. They are a very valuable tool for many employers, but they are not appropriate for all employers. And that's my concern with the mandated nature. A Section 125 plan can provide a tax benefit to individuals. It also can provide a tax benefit with respect to employers, but it doesn't always work that way. And a lot of those determinations are made on a case-by-case basis. For example, in order to get the benefit of the tax break of a 125 plan, the IRS requirements need to be followed. I'm not sure how many were around in 1993, but City of Arden Hills was caught between a rock and a hard place with respect to this. They were payroll audited by the IRS. It was determined they had no 125 plan. 3 years of W-2 filings had to be refiled by all the employees. So this is real. There are qualification requirements and operational requirements. The qualification requirements, I'll jump over, but on the operational side, one of the biggest operational requirements is the non-discrimination testing under the tax code. What that does is it imposes a responsibility on the employer to run the tests. It also places at risk the tax break for certain groups of employees. And with respect to the employer, if the testing is not done correctly and amounts are not reflected correctly as taxable income, the employer can face pretty severe penalties if they are payroll audited with respect to items that weren't withheld correctly and reporting obligations with the federal government. This is my problem with the mandate. I think that 125 plans are wonderful. They are great tools. I like the idea of providing more education, more information about how to use them and how to use them well. One of the other things in this testing that comes up to play is that when we talk about testing, we are testing on an employer basis, but it's under the controlled group rules of the tax code, which means we could have a Minnesota employer subject to this requirement, but because they also have a location in Seattle, Portland, or Wisconsin, they have to count all of those people as if they were all employed by the single employer here in order to pass the tests. So it has ramifications beyond just the Minnesota employer. Now, obviously, there's a risk to the employer in putting in place a 125 plan. That's why it typically is a business decision of the employer to look at the pros, the cons, the savings, the risks, and then make a decision about whether this is something that they can undertake. I like the idea of individual policies being available. I like the idea of Section 125 plans being able to pay those policies pre-tax. I'm just very concerned with the mandate aspect. And then finally, some of the other things on the non-discrim testing that can adversely impact Minnesota employers. There are three tests. There's the key employee test, the contributions test, and the coverage test. And for many small employers in Minnesota, the 25% key employee concentration test cannot be passed. The cafeteria plan I have in my own law firm, I can't participate in it because I can't pass the test if I'm in it. Now, you may say, well, that's okay, you're the owner, no biggie. The problem is that because of the way the target groups for these tests are defined, they actually have the ability to reach down and get at some of those very people that it would be so important to try and make sure that they can participate. So, again, it's the mandated nature of this that causes me concern. The other aspect, certainly the promotion of this as a tool, I think is fabulous.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. And I know that the authors are listening carefully and taking notes. Thank you very much. Would ask then Mr. Tyler, Ms. Braze, and Mr. Johnson, Bob Johnson, to come up. And Mr. Haas. Hello.
Chair.
Mr. Tyler, do you want to go first?
Madam Chair, thank you very much. I would like to introduce myself as a board member on Citizens Council on Healthcare. Also, I'm an independent insurance agent as well.
And give your name, please.
John Tyler.
Okay.
I also work with approximately my agency. My partner and I have approximately 300 insured small businesses in our agency. We have approximately 2,000 insured individuals in our agency, and so we have been in touch with our clients regarding their feelings about the bill. I do have a packet handout that will illustrate. If I could, if there's a page that will just speak to this, so we can all be looking on the same page. One of the, it's interesting to talk to people who represent employers, but what about what do employers think about the health insurance exchange? And what was done by Greg Dottillo and Dave Racer and administered by TRL Consulting LLC, a St. Paul actuarial firm, is a survey of employers as to what employers think about the health insurance exchange, particularly with regard to the mandate. And the first page of this particular handout reiterates the feelings of the various segments of the health insurance exchange by employers, by 337 employers between 2 and 50 employees, representing 6,500 total employees with an average employer size of 19 lives within the that were surveyed. What is very interesting here is not only the fact that there is such emphasis here, 93% oppose purchasing health insurance through the exchange.
Mr. Tyler, may I just ask,
please,
are these people that provide insurance already?
Yes. These are people who provide insurance already.
And one of they're
not required to use the exchange.
So, Mr. Tyler, that's my thought, Senator Berglund. I don't think they'd be required then to be part of this. It makes sense to me. If I were already providing insurance, I wouldn't want to, and I was satisfied with that.
One of the issues here is that there is a 0.5% initial estimate of increased cost of group insurance as well as individual premiums to help finance the insurance exchange. And I'd like to make an appeal on behalf of my clients, who emphatically said that their number one issue is affordability. It may be seen like only 0.5%, but it's 0.5% tacked on to the various mandates that already exist on the program that provide no appreciable value to those, whether they're participating in the exchange or not participating in the exchange. And so there is an emphatic feeling among small employers and large employers as well that this is not providing a value to them whatsoever as far as being required. If employers do not choose to offer a flexible spending account, as Ms. Heitzman pointed out so well, there are oftentimes very good reasons for that. There may be issues there that transcend logic that they may not wish. There are regulatory issues. There are compliance issues that go along with that, administrative issues, et cetera. Flexible spending accounts, 125 plans, if there's anything universal, they are universal. I mean, they are universally offered. Many group insurance plan or insurers offer them for free. Aflac offers them for free. So and will help administer. But there are still circumstances by which employers may not wish to offer them and would not like to be mandated, especially to pay an additional premium tax or for regular and on top of everything else. So I'd like to speak emphatically against this insurance exchange on behalf of the employer community. And my clients have asked me to relay a message to the legislature is that rather than working on ways to build overarching bureaucracies within government to address health insurance, to please address the issue of affordability. Affordability is the issue. It is the reason that they're uninsured. There are reasons that employers don't offer group insurance or individual insurance or what have you. To address the issue of mandates, look at dismantling the mandates, not adding more fees, administration, regulation, oversight, reporting, et cetera, that they are already overburdened with.
Mr. Tyler, thank you. Senator Vandeveer, we have 7 minutes.
Madam Chair, I was just going to ask, are we going to hear from the NFIB at all?
Yes. They're on the list. If these people speak quickly, we promise to listen quickly. Ms. Brace.
I shall try. Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Twyla Brace. I'm President of Citizens Council on Healthcare, and here particularly to speak against the exchange. I have 3 points and one comment at the end. The 3 points are the cost of the exchange, the power of the exchange, and the power of the new bureaucracies from this bill. So if you look at the cost of the exchange, just sort of overall, we have essentially a fourth-party payer that's going to charge an assessment on premiums. I suspect that when that assessment does not actually pay the bills like it hasn't in MCHA, then that cost will be moved to the taxpayers, just like it did in MCHA. It also limits a competitive market in policies, which is likely to lead to higher costs for the health insurance policies. And notably, the 0 to 10, you know, if you talk about the 125 plan, just to notice that the 1 to 10 employers, or they have employees just 1 to 10, 0 to 10, would never be 0, I'm sorry, 1 to 10, is that those individuals don't have to have the 125 plan, but those individuals will pay the additional assessment through the exchange. So there will not even be an offset for them as a result of being tax exempt. Another thing is the power of the exchange. It's a new bureaucracy that I really believe will eventually lead to more control than is even in this bill, and I think we have to look to the future, that once you get this entity into existence, its roles can grow, and likely those roles will be over all things insurance and eventually over all things having to do with health care and access to medical treatment. There are essentially in the exchange 11 appointees that are political appointees, and there are 5 million people in the state of Minnesota, yet those decisions will be made by those. They are exempt from rulemaking, which means that they cannot even look at the rule, make comments, have a public hearing, et cetera. So that really takes the power away from individuals. And then there's the Health Insurance Benefit and Design Committee, which is going to make determinations about what the policies need to look like that are going to be offered by the exchange. And I notice on page 44, line 25 through 27, or actually starting at line 24, that any health plan company that issues health plans in the individual or small employer market must offer through the exchange at least 3 health plans that meet the standard benefits set and design established by the Healthcare Transformation Commission. There are 11 people on that commission who will decide what kind of insurance all of us can have. The last thing is the power of these bureaucracies, which I've already referred to with the Healthcare Transformation Commission, but also to say that the state makes itself not liable for any of the actions of the exchange. And the Transformation Commission, the Benefit Design Committee, all are not liable for their decisions or their acts. So there's like no public accountability for all these new bureaucracies that are going to be started. And I'll make one comment, which is what Senator Berglund said, was that there was going to be a 20% cost reduction. I don't believe that cost reduction will be for the individual. It'll be somewhere. It might be, I mean, we don't even know that it'll be, right? To me, it really doesn't sound like it will be. But if there is one, it's not going to be to the individual, because we already see additional taxes or assessments or whatever to pay for the bureaucracy that started. And the last question I have is, where does it say that all the policies offered by the health plan must be offered in and outside of the health insurance exchange and at the same price? Noting, of course, that the people who buy it off out of the exchange will always pay a higher price because of the assessment. Thank you.
Ms. Brace, thank you. Mr. Haas, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's good to see you again.
Yes.
And I appreciate all your help you gave me in my tenure as working on health care issues, and we passed a lot of good legislation.
And committee members.
And identify yourself.
And I am Bill Haas. I own Haas Managed Benefits. And I provide benefits to a major association here in the state with over 500 member companies. And so I have clients all over the state of Minnesota, and they're all different size companies. And when I look at this exchange and the guaranteed issue, I really have some concerns because we really don't have an individual market in Minnesota. It's a real tough marketplace. It's tough to go through underwriting to get the insurance for individuals. And so they're better off in the group marketplace in the long run because they get much better benefits, their premiums are more competitive, and it's our job as brokers to then manage the cost of those of the insurance for our clients. And that's really what we do. But when we look at the going to a guaranteed issue program, we are going to lump everybody into a whole new program, and you're going to have to charge for that risk because everybody that's going to go into that guaranteed issue is not going to be a healthy person. And if you transition MSHA off of it eventually or start taking some people from MSHA, you're going to do two things. You're going to drive the rates of your pool up in your guaranteed issue, and you're also going to drive the rates of the MSHA program up because now you're going to have only the unhealthy people, the ones with real medical problems, in the MSHA pool, which is going to create a larger assessment for the small business owners of the state. So it's we really got to rethink that process on the guaranteed issue and who we're going to impact, because if we do, we're not going to impact only the 10 and above. We're going to impact the 1 to 10 employers out there who would be doing providing individual health insurance or letting their employees buy individual health insurance, because it is going to be cost prohibitive. One of the things I have seen, and this gentleman testified before as a broker, has probably sold some, is the health plans have taken the initiative to come out with a low-rate program that provides some upfront dollars for the employees to use. It's 100% dollars that they can use for whatever they need up to a certain amount, and then they have a deductible, which will help. And that has been very affordable to a lot of people, and in some cases it's actually cheaper than Minnesota Care and a lot better coverage. So I think we got to let the market do the work for us, and they are working towards this. I know we tried a number of years ago to set up the Minnesota Employee Insurance Program, the MEAT program, and that cost us $2 million, and we ended up having to write off that $2 million, and the program failed. But it tried to compete in the small employer marketplace, and it just wasn't cost-effective to do it. And the other thing, and I'll hurry up because I know Mike needs to talk, is if we don't, we can talk all day long about insurance premiums and that, but what I see, and I'm very active in my groups, is if we don't change the lifestyle of people. When I was down here, with all the food you eat down here, and you know, you're just, your diets aren't good, my cholesterol went up. And that bothered me, and I didn't want to go on medication, so I did the other. I changed my whole diet, and I got my cholesterol back down. But, you know, I go into my employer groups, and I see people that I know they're on Lipitor. I know they're on high blood pressure medication. I know their medical conditions, and they're not doing anything to change their lifestyle. And we need to do that. We need to put an active disease management component in. That's another thing. And to get people into active disease management programs, I know in a self-insured program, if I got a good active disease management program, I can take that person, and over a number of years, I can reduce their claims by 40%. But that's so these are things we have to look at. And, Madam Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to address you today.
Representative Haas, I believe that there are requirements in here for the health, preventive health kind of.
Right. Both the
Senator Berglund.
The disease management, medical home, all those things are in the bill, as well as a public health investment component in other parts of the bill.
And, Madam Chair, just to that, Senator Berglund, I know all the plans I have today that I offer have websites for healthy lifestyles and diets and, you know, where to go to the gym, and they'll pay for health club membership. But you know what? You still see it. People do not take the initiative, and that's the problem. How do we get those people? You know, we can legislate all we want, but how do we get them into the programs? That's the key.
Thank you. Mr. Hickey. I would swear that I saw Mr. Johnson there.
Madam Chair, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. Bob Johnson graciously yielded his spot to me, and I'm probably going to be the last person. I did have a 20-minute prepared statement, but I'm going to toss that considering the circumstances.
Thank you.
Just kidding. Wanted to make a couple of really...
I knew that.
I never have a 20-minute prepared statement. I think that would get you less around here than more. I just want to make a couple of brief comments. As you know, I represent the National Federation of Independent Business. We're the largest business group in terms of entities with 14,000 members and probably one of the most affected constituencies. When you look through this bill, you see small employer constantly. And there's a lot of good ideas here. There's some we need to flesh out further, but we do have just a couple of significant concerns. The first one is regarding the Section 125 requirement or mandate we're discussing. You know, I think some good could come of it. I think the opt-out is really important, though, because these are people who aren't offering health insurance and don't know anything about Section 125 plans. And Ms. Heitzman brought up some very good points about things we need to flush out, but I think the opt-out is critical. I want to thank the authors for putting it in. I'd strongly urge you to make it indefinite because, once again, these are employers that don't offer health insurance, don't know a single thing about Section 125 plans, and we can't put this kind of burden on them because they're not even capable of dealing with it because they're not even involved with the health insurance policy. And I think there are some very complicated problems with 125 plans. Because of that, I think we should actually seek an advisory opinion from the Federal Department of Labor. I know Senator Berglund's tracking what's going on in other states. I don't know if it's exactly what we're doing to a T or if there are little deviations in the other states, but I think it would be a smart idea to seek an advisory opinion. The second thing is we are concerned about the premium tax assessments for the exchange of apparently up to 0.5. That's another 0.5 on top of the 2% MCHA burden we've been dealing with. And, Madam Chair, you've helped us out tremendously over the years trying to do something on that. But that 2% falls, up to 2%, falls on small employers, doesn't fall on the largest, richest companies in this state, doesn't fall on the majority of employers in this state who have all fled to the federal ERISA market. And we're concerned about that. One idea is possibly only those who use the exchange seek the benefits of the exchange should pay an assessment. Maybe it'd have to be higher, but at least those are people using it. We're also concerned about the savings offset assessment of up to 4%. I don't quite understand how it works, but if we're asking companies to project savings and then assess, I mean, I hope the savings are really going to be there if they're going to have to actually start assessing people for it. But one thought is, small business really needs a lifeline. Small business owners are desperate in the health insurance area. Why couldn't savings be passed on? I guess people want more revenue, but the fact that they're trying to assess savings possibly before they happen, a little concerned about that. But those are our three biggest concerns, and I want to share them with you as we go forward.
Mr. Hickey, thank you. And I think that the authors are listening to your concerns. I think they probably have heard most of them maybe before, but I think it's helpful to all of us because I think this is a work in progress. Erin Sexton is here someplace. There she is. And then, Mr. Johnson, did you? we got a little extra time, but we really have to be out of here at 3:15. So, Sexton, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Erin Sexton, and I'm the Director of Healthcare Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We're very pleased that this Senate file 3099 takes significant steps toward reforming our health system, and are hopeful that these steps will reduce the cost and improve the quality of our healthcare system, creating a much better value equation for purchasers and users of the healthcare system. However, we do have concerns with just a few pieces, I think, relevant to this committee. And I can essentially say ditto to what Mr. Hickey just said, because we do have significant concerns about creating a Section 125 mandate. If the health insurance exchange does provide the benefits that many hope it will, employers will establish the Section 125 voluntarily. And there are administrative costs for establishing and administering these plans, and each employer should be able to make the decision on what makes the most sense for their business and their employees. In addition, Mr. Hickey also mentioned this, it does establish an additional 0.5 assessment onto the ones that we already have. And last, I know he also mentioned this, but the health savings reinvestment assessment established in Article 4, Section 24, which essentially equates to an additional premium tax on those who are purchasing health insurance in the private market. And coupled with the assessment allowed to fund the health insurance exchange, this bill will be adding additional taxes and fees onto the many we already have. So addressing health care costs is a priority for our members, and although there are many pieces in this bill that we are hopeful will accomplish this, we do not believe an additional assessment will help in that goal. So I appreciate the time of the committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, are there questions or discussion? Senator Vandeveer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've heard a great deal of talk about the Minnesota Health Insurance Exchange, and so I would like to move that we delete Section 13 on page 43.
That would be the the creation of the Health Insurance Exchange. You just want to remove all of Section 13.
I believe, Madam
Chair, takes you to page halfway through page 48.
And that would take care of the half percent, too. That would eliminate that. Is that Mr. Stang?
Madam Chair, I've been looking for the half percent assessment for the health exchange, and I haven't found it yet, so I don't know if the authors could help me or the committee or not.
Senator Berglund, do you know where that is?
I got a 3 o'clock meeting. I got to go to...
It's near the end. Very near the end.
Where's the end?
Health exchange section? No, I think it's in there.
Deposit of assessments. I'm looking at the top of page 62, so it's on 61.
It's a function of the duties of the exchange to establish fees to offset the administrative costs. We estimate it would be 0.5%. So it's in the duties of the board.
So Senator Vandeveer is moving to delete Section 13 from the bill. That's the creation of the Health Insurance Exchange. And Senator Berglund?
Madam Chair, we would oppose that amendment. The establishment of the exchange serves two purposes, as I said earlier. One, to help individuals who have employers who don't offer coverage to get the benefit of the 125 plan. We don't have the option of just telling the federal government how they should structure the tax system, so this is the way that we can get this benefit for them. And the second thing is to help people compare more apples to apples, you know, within the insurance market, to determine what would best meet their needs through a website. And the RAND Corporation has said that when we make it easier for people to purchase insurance, we have more people purchasing insurance. And that is our goal. And so we would oppose the removal of this section of the bill. It's a very critical piece and a very important piece. And without it, I'm sure some of the other pieces start to fall apart.
Senator Rosen.
And quickly. Madam Chair, very briefly, too, the Transformation Committee and the Health Care Access Committee, along with the Governor's Office, came with this proposal. So this is an integral part of this entire reform package on health care.
So on Senator Vandeveer's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No.
Division.
The division's called for. Those in favor, raise your hand. Those opposed. Chair's hearing is still intact. The motion fails. The amendment is not adopted.
All right, Chair.
Senator Vandeveer?
I have another amendment. I move to delete. Looks like it would be the assessment on page 60. That would be section 18, I believe.
Don't have my glasses. Are you talking about section 24 on page 60, Senator Vandeveer?
Yes, Madam Chair.
This is the health savings reinvestment assessment.
I would request a roll call, Madam Chair. And this is about an $800 to $1 billion tax increase that's estimated to be included in here. It is it's very similar to the MCHA assessment, so I think it's very important that this committee deal with this.
And I think it's important. I think that it's not possible, perhaps in this bill, to quantify the savings that will be realized. So the true cost is not really that figure you just gave, I believe. I mean, there's a cost to it, but I think that it's offset by savings. But Senator Berglund or Senator Rosen, did you want to comment on that?
Madam Chair, I would oppose this amendment. This is a very critical piece of the bill also. First of all, there's not one dime of assessment generated unless there are savings. And the savings will be determined based on what we are spending today, what the projected growth of our health care system would be, and then what it is under the bill once it's enacted. Two-thirds of those savings go to the premium payers in the state of Minnesota. One-third are recaptured as a dividend for the state to do a number of things. One, to make health care insurance affordable, both through the exchange, through subsidies in the exchange, as well as through Minnesota Care. The second thing is to invest in our need for more primary care physicians. We have a shortage coming of primary care physicians, and without primary care physicians, the cost of our system goes up. To invest in things like making the payment difference between Medicaid and the private market smaller. So there are things that we would do to reinforce the insurance reform in the bill through this savings offset. This was an agreement that was reached with the governor as to how this bill should be paid for, and he feels very strongly that when we generate savings, then and only then should we expand the spending that we're doing.
Oh, Senator Berglund, and that's a concept that I agree with wholeheartedly. Members, let's vote. Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, I think this might be a little bit of counting your chickens before they hatch, counting on the savings, but it is good if there are the savings that Senator Berglund and others project. It would be reasonable to take some of it to fund some of these things. So, I think it may be not as much money as you think it's going to be, if any, but I think it's reasonable if there is savings to take. So.
On the Vandiver motion to delete Section 24, which is that health savings reinvestment assessment, all those in favor say aye.
Chair asked for a roll call.
I'm sorry, you did. Forgive me, Senator Vandiver.
Clerk
will take the roll. I'm sorry.
Senator Shy?
No.
Senator Dahl?
No.
Yes.
Senator Murray?
No.
Senator Metzen?
No.
Senator Olson?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I just walked in, so
I know you
really
did.
Know
it's
what
not
this
fair.
Amendment
you're supposed to be
about.
Meeting in here as we
yes.
speak. I know.
So
I'm,
I wonder if, can I,
no.
is it, do I need to vote?
Could, no.
If
no.
I haven't been
no,
here?
No, you don't.
Okay.
Senator Crenshaw?
No.
Senator Scogin?
No.
Senator Sparks?
I'm going to try that.
No.
Senator Vandiver?
Yes.
I think it's 7-2. Okay, the motion fails.
Madam Chair, one more quick amendment if I could.
Yes, Senator Vandiver.
Okay, Madam Chair, it would be on the $40 million hospital tax that's in here, and that would be on, I believe, houses here, page 4, it looks like.
They don't.
Page 1. I would request a roll call on this too, Madam Chair.
Section
3, page 4. Yes.
And arguably, I mean, there is a connection to our committee, but Senator Berglund, do you want to say?
Madam Chair, I think it would only be in order if this amendment is going to be offered that you would have to delete the public health improvement program as well. This is a dedicated source of funding to pay for this program. So I think it would only be in order then that Section 1 on page 1 through page 6.
So all of Article
line,
1.
Right.
All of
Article 1. And I would oppose that motion. Both the Health Care Access Commission, all of the task forces of that commission that reviewed this, and the Governor's Transformation Task Force felt it was very important for us to be investing in improving the public health of this state. And that The programs that would be invested in have been piloted to show that they do have improved health outcomes, and therefore we would have reduced health care spending. And so removing that from the bill would be removing an important long-term cost savings feature of the bill. And this is the mechanism that we've agreed with the governor's office would be appropriate to pay for this. It would be a short-term 5-year investment, and then presuming the program is successful, after that it could come out of the health care savings.
So, Mr. Stagg, very quickly, would deleting that other article be a must-do, in your opinion, on this? Or just deleting the $40 million hospital tax, could we do that alone?
Senator Vandiver, I'm not an expert at all in this article. I assume this would create a hole in what Senator Berglund's trying to do in public health, but I think you have the right to offer your amendment
to offer it. Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The recommendation from the Transformation Task Force was an increase in the tobacco tax or fee. So this was a compromise that came from the governor's office. And as was said here, the prevention piece is an integral part of this whole reform, and we have to keep it intact. And it would have to be taken out.
Senator Vandiver.
Madam Chair, so if this health care reform is $1 billion in new taxes, let's just go with the way they'd like to do it. Beat the whole article.
Senator Olson, did you want to say something?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I was just going to affirm what Senator Berglund said, and that I don't think you can do this unless you have identified a way to pay for it. And so I don't know how you could take out the part of how you'd pay for it and achieve this. That being said, I guess my personal feeling is that this is a public health responsibility, and putting this onto particular insurance products or the nonprofit hospitals. Taking over what has been a state responsibility for public health without really, I don't support that. I mean, that's one of a number of things in this bill that I don't support. So, and one of the reasons why I don't feel I can support the overall proposal. But I do agree with Senator Berglund that if we're going to do this, that we can't just take out the payment mechanism.
Senator Johnson, did you want to say something?
Madam Chair, I have a question after this vote.
Okay. Thank you. There's a roll call that's been requested. Yep. The clerk will.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Take our roll.
Senator Shy?
No.
Senator Dahl?
No.
Senator Johnson?
Yes.
Senator Marty?
No.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Senator Prentice-Owen?
No.
Senator Sparks?
No.
Senator Vandiver?
Yes.
Okay, it's 5-2-3. The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 13, Subdivision 18 exempts the...
Can you tell us the page?
Page 48. It's an exemption from rulemaking authority. Who then has oversight of the governance board?
Senator Berglund, did you hear the question?
Is this the health insurance exchange?
This is the section 120. Mm-hmm. Are you up above what lines?
It's a
yes. Well, the members of the exchange are appointed either by the governor's office or by the House or the Senate, so they're all responsible to elected bodies.
Madam Senator Johnson?
Getting outside of the Commerce or the DHS, I just think that there should be oversight other than their own governance board. I have to put that on the record.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I would say that the reason for this is that it would delay considerably our being able to begin this project.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Johnson.
What committee does this go to from here?
Judiciary.
Perfect.
Judiciary. And that certainly is an appropriate topic there. And then it will go to state and local government as well.
Right.
So, but is it the intent, is it going to go to judiciary from here if it passes today? Okay. Was that an amendment? No. Yes, Senator Vandiver?
Roll call on the $1 billion medical bill.
Senator Vandiver has asked for a roll call on this bill, which I believe implies significant savings, and we know we need to have to, we must move forward from what and take a step toward fixing what is a terribly broken system. Senator Prettner-Solin.
Madam Chair, has anybody moved the bill?
No, would you do that?
I would move the bill.
Senator Prettner-Solin moves that Senate File 3099 as amended, because we had an amendment early, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, just a comment that I think there's a lot of wonderful things in the bill, especially the first three articles. I do have ongoing concerns about the administrative structure that's getting put in place here, because I'm not convinced it's going to save the money, and I don't think, even if it works exactly the way the authors hope, that it's going to fix our medical problems about getting people insured and saving money. But I understand this.
Senator Marty, right. And I think that the authors are continuing to work with all parties and all stakeholders in trying to make this work. I don't know that this is the bill we'll see on the floor at the end of the day. I don't know that, but I think it's important that we keep moving and trying to make this work. Senator Olson.
And Madam Chair, I just also like to say, because I'm not going to vote for this bill either, that I really appreciate all the work that Senator Berglund, Senator Rosen, and others have done. I agree with you, our system is broken, but I think it's very important when we look at the direction that we're going that we move in the right direction. And there are certainly some wonderful things in this bill, but the overall direction that we're moving to me reminds me of the No Child Left Behind Act and what that did for education. And I'm concerned that we're just putting more costs and more things that are going to add to the bureaucracy and cost, with the hope that people's are going to be healthier and that we're going to see savings as a result of that. But honestly, if you look at other countries and their health care systems, they use their health care or access health care more than people in this country do. And so I don't think we're looking in the right places for cost savings necessarily. Some of this I would agree with, but much of it I don't.
Thank you. On the request for a roll call, the clerk will take the roll. Yes.
Senator
Dahl?
Yes.
Senator Johnson?
No.
Senator Marty?
No.
Senator Olson?
No.
Senator Prettner-Solin?
Yes.
Senator Scobie?
Yes.
Senator Sparks?
Yes.
Senator Van
Buren? No.
The vote is 5-4. The motion prevails. The bill is
thank you, members.
To pass and referred to judiciary.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody who testified. Tonight we are starting at six, members of the committee. We are starting at 6 p.m. sharp. We have to do that. Members and staff are invited to G9 about 5:30, and there will be some supper for you. And so that's at G9 is where my office is. We will be hearing Senator Stump's auctioneer's bill. Senator Olson has a small bill on cemetery funding. She has her wireless bill that we began to hear. Senator Carlson has his automobile damage disclosure. And Senator Betzold has the school employees' health pool. That is tonight, and I think we can do that in 3 hours. And we are in recess.
For most families, this is